Welcome to this podcast series asking the question, can art save us? I'm starting the first national and international conversation about courage and curiosity. What do these qualities really mean and why does it make a big difference to our mental, societal and democratic health? I talk to award-winning and diverse artists across the arts to explore these qualities in their lives and work, both to inspire and for us all to learn. I'm exploring why we need these qualities to help change the global epidemic of mental illness, loneliness, polarisation of our communities, and even global conflict. If the arts cultivate courage and curiosity, I'm asking the question, can art save us? My guest today is Casa Pancho, MBE, who in 2001 founded Ballet Black, Britain's most diverse ballet company celebrating dancers of Black and Asian descent. Today, it's one of the most prolific commissioners of new and critically acclaimed ballets here in the UK. The journey in between, however, has been huge. Racist barriers in the industry were high, and it was only 6 years ago that the world-leading designer Fried of London, in collaboration with Ballet Black, developed the UK's first range of point shoes for dancers with darker skin tones. The exclusively pink or pale ballet shoe had long reigned as the symbol of a white-centric ballet world, a clear statement of racist exclusion. It was trying to write her dissertation for a degree in the art and teaching of classical ballet that Casa realised she couldn't interview Black women in British ballet because there weren't any. As a young graduate, Casa started Ballet Black. It was a brave undertaking. Starting a new company is normally built around a star dancer, and no one was likely to take her seriously. But Ballet Black offered a space where Black and Asian dancers could come without feeling othered or marginalised, and even a basic dance class was hugely popular. This is the work of a pioneer leading positive change. Black ballerinas being told they could only be cast in male roles or to break their feet because they didn't fit a preferred white body type are racist traumas to be left in the dust of this trailblazing work. Ballet Black is making a fundamental change in the diversity of classical ballet and audiences in Britain. Everyone is invited, and I was lucky enough to invite Casa Pancho to join me today. Hello, Casa, and thank you for joining me.
Hi, Paula. Thanks for asking me.
Casa, I wondered if we could go back to the significance of the ballet shoe that I referred to in the introduction, finally being designed in a range of different flesh tones. What amazes me is we are only talking about 6 years ago. I think it was 2018 where yourself and one of your dancers, Chira Robinson,
that's right.
Yeah. Develops this with Fried. This seems to be such an evident statement of exclusion. Why on earth did it take so long, do you think?
I think it wasn't necessarily deliberate exclusion. It's just that because the ballet world is overwhelmingly Caucasian, nobody really thought about it. So before we made the shoe with Fried, a company in America called Gaynor Minden, about 4 years prior to the Fried shoe coming out, were making three or four shades of brown, light brown to dark brown. But the kind of shoe it wasn't a universally used shoe. And we didn't see it over here. And we didn't have the same level of social media and the ability to see what's going on in all other ballet companies across the world. Like now I could tell you what's going on at New York City Ballet or American Ballet Theatre just from following them on Instagram. Whereas back then we didn't have that same ease of exchange of information. So, you know, when you start a company like Ballet Black, there are so many things you need to tackle. To be honest, the shoe was one of the last things that we even thought about doing. And it all came out of Chira Robinson, who is a Black American ballerina who wears Fried shoes, going into the shop to buy her usual supply of pink shoes and noticing on the counter there were loads of satin samples in every color under the rainbow except brown. And she asked, are these to make custom shoes? They said, yes, we can make any color you like. And she said, can you do brown? And they said, oh, that's the one color we don't do. Go away and find us some brown satin. We can make you a brown customized shoe. And unbeknownst to me, Chira went out looking for satin. Then one day she finally told me what she was doing. And I said, let's talk to Fried and let's get them to find the satin, because they are the shoe experts, not us. And from there, we were able to work with Fried to come up with these two shades, bronze and brown.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a brilliant, happy collaboration, isn't it? And isn't it incredible that it's almost just stumbling into the shop, so to speak, to see those rainbow colours. But at least it, you know, raising that all important question. And of course, this led to a fantastic collaboration and celebration with Stormzy at Glastonbury. And I wondered if you'd like to share what happened for the listeners, because I imagine the impact of what happened at Glastonbury was huge, if not transformative.
Yes, it was. It feels like so long ago now. So Stormzy and Ballet Black were already looking for something that we could do together. And had been talking for a couple of years, but, you know, schedules didn't allow it just wasn't an easy, straightforward thing, because he just sort of took off to an incredible stratospheric level at the time that we were talking. And we were becoming increasingly busy with our touring. This is all pre-pandemic. Then he got the Glastonbury gig. And his creative team, one of the people on it, Amber Rimmel, was very into ballet and had just heard about the shoes coming out and suggested this might be the way we can work with Ballet Black. And he loved, well, first of all, he was shocked that this didn't exist, as a lot of people were. They just thought that these brown shoes had existed forever. And he wanted to create a platform in his set to give a lot of different people a voice, including us. So going onto that pyramid stage, first of all, we've never done anything on that scale. It was also televised. So the, I think, 200,000 people that were there was then multiplied by all the people watching at home on TV. So we hit, over a million people, I think, saw that and saw that these shoes existed and found out that Ballet Black even existed, because perhaps they didn't know about us either. So it was a kind of a transformative landmark moment for Ballet Black.
Yeah, I can imagine it. It must have almost been overwhelming, really. I did catch an interview clip with one of the dancers who'd been on that stage, and he said it was completely life-changing. And I wondered what your conversations were about that, how it was life-changing.
I think when you perform in a theater, even a big theater for us is about 1,500 people, and they sit quietly while you perform. And then if you've done a good job, hopefully they will clap or maybe cheer at the end. When you are with Stormzy, it's a very different experience. So we went out onto this stage already, Glastonbury, he was the nighttime actor. I think the anticipation and the excitement had been building all day. And when we got out there, I watched from the side of the stage. When we got out there, the sound of the crowd cheering was, I mean, it was unlike anything you could ever experience in a theater. The volume of people, the volume of the cheering. And I think the dancers could almost not hear the music. There was so much noise from the audience. And nothing can prepare for that. We went for rehearsals with Stormzy on, they rebuilt the set in a studio for us to rehearse everything. But nothing can prepare you for that audience and the audience reaction that we got.
Yeah. I mean, quite frightening as well, actually, if you can't actually hear the music you're performing to, but immensely exciting. That level of celebration, and particularly, you know, from the position you've come from, the lack of celebration, if you like, you know, of Black and Asian dancers to that moment. I can only imagine it was absolutely incredible. And it seems to me that, of course, it's the art of collaboration that Ballet Black does so brilliantly well. And as part of how you diversify the ballet experience. So, for example, you incorporate poetry, music, film, different choreographers. Are these all deliberate ways of how you want to widen, diversify audiences, but also change the conversation about what ballet is?
I think it's a combination. So, for example, the ballet you're talking about with poetry, the choreographer came with this idea to use the poems as the soundtrack to the ballet, and so he brought that idea to us, and then we took it and we ran with it. But certainly, you know, starting a company with only, I think we had 6 dancers at the beginning, you already can't do the existing ballet repertoire. So we couldn't do Swan Lake or Giselle or Sleeping Beauty because we didn't have enough people. And we're also in the same city as the Royal Ballet and English National Ballet. So
yeah,
we didn't need to reinvent the wheel on that in any way. So out of necessity, we needed to find work that would, you know, show us off in a great way, but also spark the interests of people to come and see this unknown company. And so what started out as necessity actually became one of the most interesting things that we were doing. And so it was sort of by accident that we have built up this repertoire. You know, for the first few years, it wasn't necessarily the goal to create this interesting new work, but we just were by default because we were getting in young choreographers that would never have a hope of getting work put on at a big opera house or a big ballet company, because it's just not the way things work back then. Things are opening up much more now, but in those days, you know, 22 years ago, all the ballet companies were doing work by mostly deceased choreographers and the big classic pieces, which of course we don't want to lose from the ballet repertoire. But I think there was a whole other audience that we tapped into that weren't necessarily interested in the story that Swan Lake was telling them, but wanted to come and see something that felt a bit more relevant to them or more of interest to them.
Yeah, and actually, this is something that that's exactly the point that stood out to me, actually, when I was reading about the production Then or Now, which, of course, is the ballet that incorporated Adrienne Rich's poetry. And it was from the Sky Arts documentary, actually, that William Tuckett, who was the choreographer, said that creating work for Ballet Black had felt very different to previous collaborations. It was still exciting, but he was very aware of a great responsibility, and that was asking those questions: whose story should the dancers be telling? And in times of political upheaval and social change. So I was interested in what your conversations were in relation to that at that time of creating Then or Now.
Well, we started to make this ballet just before the pandemic. So this ballet has gone through kind of a change affected by worldwide events. So Will initially, we wanted to make another ballet. This is our third, this became our third collaboration. And I knew I wanted him to make something for us. And we met to talk about ideas. And at that time, the Windrush scandal was becoming increasingly loud in the press. And it was getting to be a bigger and bigger and bigger issue. And Will, who is a white middle-class English man really wanted to make something about that. And that didn't really sit well with me. We're a company of people of African and Afro-Caribbean descent, and it didn't feel like we wanted this story, even in collaboration with us, to be told by a Caucasian person. So we talked more and more, and he understood that. And at the same time, Brexit was happening or about to happen. And that felt like it hit a different group of people, but it was being boiled down to the same issue of, we don't want you here, or you don't belong here, or go back to where you came from, which was something the Windrush people were being told. And then it became something the European citizens that lived in the UK were being told by certain factions. So at the same time, Will was looking at a lot of this poetry by Adrian Rich. And even though it wasn't written about those specific events, it really resonated. And it sounded like we could be talking about people being deported to Jamaica or to Europe and being told, go back to where you came from, when actually, although there are roots in the Caribbean or roots in Europe, we're from here. This is the only place we know is the UK. So what does that mean for people that have roots elsewhere or heritage from other places, but they don't necessarily call that home? And that was something that really resonated, certainly for me as a half Trini with a dad who came over from Trinidad, but he, at the age of 12, would not consider Trinidad to be his first home. He would consider London to be that. So that really sparked my interest, and that felt like a better creation point for a choreographer like Will to work with a company like ours and to try and tell a story, because we let Adrian Rich's words do the work for us in that way. She was a known activist, really fighting for gay rights and for the civil rights movement in the US. She was a big advocate for all of those things. So it felt like she was also one of the right people to speak for us in a way. And so we developed this ballet. Then the pandemic came. And, something that we could never have predicted. And these Windrush, Brexit, all these issues got worse and worse and worse, as well as the global pandemic. And when we came back to finally stage it, it just felt like we were saying even more, because during the pandemic, we had the 2020 resurgence of the Black Lives Matter movement. We had the murder of George Floyd, and that really turned a lot of things in the ballet world on its head. So some of the poems became almost confrontational, as though we were saying them to the audience or to the ballet industry. And it really changed the heat, I think, on the ballet.
Yeah, it's incredibly significant when you put this into context of such huge social and political upheavals. It certainly raises significant questions, doesn't it, about belonging. And there's so many things that raises, but it does really stand out to me that your personal experience is so significant. It's so strange to read you say, I passed as being super white. And of course, this gave you unique insights, because the fact that people didn't perceive you as someone of dual heritage, as you said, your father was from Trinidad, and I understand your mom is white British. And so you were a witness, weren't you, to basically racism or language or comments that would not have been made if it was understood that you were actually a Black presence. I wondered if you could bring that to life for us, what that strange experience must be like.
Oof. Well, I became aware of it, of being different, I think, when I got to high school or secondary school, as I think people call it now, and just realizing things like parents' evening, that most people's parents were either both black or brown or both white, and there weren't that many mixed families. And I remember, you know, my teachers being surprised when they saw both my parents, and when certain people found out, you know, there were some BNP, well, I assume the children of BNP members at my sixth form, who would tell me very earnestly that each of my parents were traitors to their race, and that as a crossbreed, I really shouldn't be here.
Sorry, I mean, I know this is audio, but my face is literally in my hands. The language is just so shocking.
Well, I also think, I don't know what, I don't expect any other way, really. So it doesn't feel shocking to me. But yeah, so that was the kind of thing that I would hear. And I became really aware of the switch from people not knowing or assuming I was one thing, and then finding out, and then, you know, making those kinds of comments that I hadn't heard from them before till they discovered that I'm mixed. So that's just been normal for me, I think, for my, as long as I can remember, through childhood. And now I'm in Ballet Black, and it's a place where everyone knows, you know, what we are, and, you know, there's no judgment, or no, it's a positive thing. It's welcomed here that you're black or mixed or whatever. So it's not something I've carried through. And, you know, nowadays, you know, our ballet school is made up of loads of different, you know, cultures, heritage, color, race. So, you know, it feels very much like something of the time. I was growing up in the 80s and 90s. And, but it gave me this insight into the code switching, I suppose, might be how you would describe it, where when you think you can say something about either a race or gay people or whatever, because you think there's no representation in the room, and then how you behave when there is someone there, and how people can switch for public appearance, it really started to make me think, how would one go about getting through the classical ballet world if you are unambiguously black, and you know that people think these things or say these things or believe these things? They won't say it to your face. So there's a constant, very British, passive aggressive keeping down, you know, people being kept down or kept in their so-called place because it doesn't fit the stereotype that people in power believe should be all present all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And it really alerts me to an enormous amount of courage you possess. I know you may not necessarily perceive yourself as courageous, perhaps, but perhaps that also comes from your parents, in terms of them championing, you know, their relationship, their marriage, their identity, and ensuring that obviously you would have a positive identity. I wondered if part of that was the fact that it was your dad, I think, who took you off to ballet when you were maybe as young as 2.5, for example. Was that all about building confidence and ensuring you had a sense, you know, the right to have your identity in any setting?
I'm not going to lie. I don't think in, you know, the early 80s, my parents were thinking like that. Both parents wanted to make sure my brother and I were occupied, you know, so we weren't getting into trouble. So he was sent off to karate and tennis. I was sent off to ballet. I don't think it was anything more than that was the available hobby that we could get to in Acton and Ealing at that time. So I don't think my parents ever thought like that. They just wanted to make sure we were not getting up to no good. So I think it took them by surprise where my ballet career took me. Because for them, you know, it's just, this is just life, you know, this is a hobby I was doing. And I don't think they ever thought I could make it a job.
Yeah. But because nevertheless, of course, taking you off to ballet obviously became like a really huge door opener onto who you are today and your life today. So interestingly, you obviously studied at Durham University. And as I mentioned in the introduction, that's when you were alerted to the fact, you know, with your dissertation research, you couldn't actually access Black ballet dancers in Britain at that time. And so I wondered if you were pointed much more at the ballet history in the USA, for example, you know, where there's huge stories with people like Catherine Dunham, who founded the first Black dance company. And that was in 1944. So, you know, immensely progressive. Is that where you almost inevitably had to look for the kind of research or role models that you wanted to encounter?
Yes. I mean, what was available to me in history books that we had in 1999, 2000, and about Black people in ballet, what I could look into was Janet Collins, one of the first Black ballerinas in the US, and Raven Wilkinson. So although I was very aware of Catherine Dunham, because she wasn't a classical ballet dancer, I really kept the focus quite narrow on ballet. And obviously Dance Theatre of Harlem was the biggest thing in the US at the time. At that time, it was a 30-member company. There was an old VHS tape of, what was the ballet? Their Creole Giselle in our library. And I was able to watch that and see Black ballet dancers. Because again, you know, back then, if anyone listening is not in our age group, there was no Facebook, there was no YouTube, I even had an email address at that time. So to be able to see what else was going on in the world was not as easy as it is now. So finding this VHS tape of Dance Theatre of Harlem was like just like finding treasure, and being able to watch Virginia Johnson. She was the lead in the piece, and the entire cast from corps de ballet up to the lead ballerina were all Black. Was amazing. So that was really a big part of the research, was what happened with Dance Theatre of Harlem. And to get a classical ballet perspective, I was able to interview a African-American ballerina called Aisha Ash, who at the time was in New York City Ballet. And they happened to be touring to Edinburgh. So I was able to get a letter to the theatre and she wrote back to me. I also spoke to Black British contemporary dancers in the UK, and some male ballet dancers as well. And just overwhelmingly, what I heard back from the British dancers of the women was, I was always told, there is no future for you in ballet, so don't even focus on it. Go into commercial dance, go into African, go into contemporary musical theatre. You cannot go into ballet. You haven't got the body for it. They're not looking for Black dancers. You know, it's a dead end. So what I was discovering was a sort of method of advice given by teachers that, well-meaning or not, was also diverting any possible talent towards other dance forms or out of dance completely. And so there was a real dearth of classical ballet talent, because it was never given an opportunity to blossom, you know, to fail or win on its own merits. It was already encouraged into other avenues.
Yeah, and this, everything you've said is very clearly stated in the documentary, The Uncomfortable Truth of Being a Black Ballerina. And this is one of Ballet Black's ballerinas, Marie Astrid Moncey. And I think, you know, it was a very clear statement that she was making, that being a Black woman in the ballet world, and as you've just said, if you weren't already pushed out, meant you had to constantly prove your worth. And this is by no means easy. We're talking about surviving bullying. Mental exhaustion and depression can come with that. You know, again, there's huge courage to be committed to surviving this space where barriers are so high. I wondered if, again, you'd like to share what your exchanges may have been with Marie around her experiences and then happily joining you at Ballet Black.
Well, Marie doesn't work for Ballet Black anymore. So I'm always wary of sharing other people's experience. But what I can say is that any dancer in Ballet Black is able to come to work and focus on the work. So what we're interested in is your ballet. We are not here to say, can you powder your skin to look lighter? We're not here to say, flatten your hair, get rid of any curves in your body. That is something that is eliminated. So all those little obvious and subtle and unconscious barriers and bias that other ballet companies may carry don't exist here. So what you can do here is be free to be the artist you want to be. And I think that's probably one of the biggest achievements of Ballet Black, is creating an environment where that is all you have to focus on. And we're not going to say, you're too dark for this, or you need to be lighter, or you need to do anything like that. That has never come up here, and it never will, because that is not the essence of Ballet Black.
Yeah, it's the freedom to be an artist. And I imagine
other artists are allowed to be in other companies.
Yeah, and to be able to be an artist without perhaps having to wade through all of the colour coding and the tags.
And those aren't always obvious. And sometimes it's just that because you're the only Black person in a room of 30 white people, there may be no overt racism or abuse going on, but you are still carrying something, and all of that is removed here.
Yeah. And this really relates to the conversation. I had the privilege to interview the dance legend and choreographer Gregory Makoma in the last season. And for listeners who may not be familiar with his work, Gregory is from South Africa, and he's achieved this immense dance career, but he survived the first 21 years of his life under the apartheid system of South Africa. It's truly astonishing what he has achieved personally, professionally, artistically, with such immense and particularly cruel barriers against him. But what a joy that you have also worked with Gregory Makoma, and this is Black Sun. And I wondered how your collaboration came about, and was that about being able to honour ancestry, being able to represent Black history, being able to celebrate your own identity?
I think so. I think that everything that happened with George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter movement during the pandemic really ripped off a barrier. So prior to that, although we have been, you know, highlighting issues and trying to talk about things, I still felt sometimes it was hard to say to a Caucasian person, what you're doing is objectifying, or you're applying some unconscious bias, because I didn't have all those terms to use. So I just knew that I didn't feel good about, you know, a choreographer or something that was being said in the ballet world. And then with the murder of George Floyd and everybody suddenly posting a black square on Instagram and saying, we want to do better, it just sort of lifted the last barrier for me in being able to just say, what you're doing is out of order, and let me tell you why, and then you can decide what you want to do about it. So that also unlocked a desire in me to make sure we were telling more either Black historical stories or stories by Black or Asian voices. And I had seen Gregory had brought his company to the UK probably in 2019. And I went to see his show at the Barbican. I didn't know anything about him except that he was from South Africa. And his show was amazing. And it was the Ravel the Bolero show. And I thought, oh my God, I have to get this guy to come and make something for Ballet Black. And I stayed for the post-show Q&A. And in it, he spoke about ballet and how he's not interested in working with ballet because it's a kind of a colonial art form that he just had no interest for him. And I thought, oh no, he's never going to come and make something for us. But then during the actual pandemic, we made a film called Eightfold, and I asked 8 choreographers to make a solo for each of our 8 dancers. And we have a South African dancer in the company called Matutuzeli November, who has since gone on to become a very great choreographer. But at the time, I was looking for a solo for him. I wanted to inspire each of our 8 dancers because we were in a very difficult place, not being able to perform, not being able to come into work. And I wanted to create something for them to keep them going during this weird time when we didn't know what we could and couldn't do. So I thought this would be the greatest choreographer for Matutuzeli to have. And I contacted Gregory and he agreed, and he made this beautiful solo for us for our film Eightfold. And from there, I kind of opened the door to a little bit of ballet, and I asked him if he would, you know, when the pandemic had ended and he would be able to fly again, would he consider coming to make something? And he said yes. And he didn't say anything about the ballet, thank God. And he's actually quite interested in using the pointe shoes because he was quite fascinated in the way the women could move across the stage looking like they were floating, which can only really be achieved with pointe shoes when you're doing ballet. So he came back, or he came to Ballet Black to make a piece. And he said, you know, I want to look at what it means to have ancestors and to acknowledge and be led by your ancestors, which is not a very British way of thinking, I think. And it really resonated with the dancers, and it turned into this incredible, very moving piece that we toured for a year and called Black Sun. And so that's how we got together to make a piece.
Yeah, no, it's a beautiful collaboration, and particularly, of course, with all of those shared values. And do you think at the end of that year, there was maybe a new wealth of learning or knowledge that came out of that for both of you?
I think so, because we went to places making his ballet that we hadn't really gone to as a company. We had to really confront our own heritage, and not in a negative way, but we had to really think about, you know, for those of us that are mixed, some of us have, you know, contact more with the Caucasian side of the family, or more contact with the Black or Caribbean side of our family. And so it wasn't necessarily always a comfortable space for all of us to be in. But you know, working with Gregory and with each other, we were able to delve in and find this really beautiful piece of work, and it wasn't necessarily a big hit with the Caucasian critics, but with our audience, it was a completely different thing. We had people sitting in their seats for 10 minutes after the show, just letting it sink in. And I think, you know, that's another example of how traditional ballet and what we're doing doesn't always necessarily sit well together, because I think the critics didn't really understand what they were seeing, because it had no, didn't really mean anything to them, because it wasn't coming from their place of knowledge or their own culture and heritage. And so that was a very revealing moment for me in ballet, that a lot of the critics said, well, I could see the audience liked it, but I had no idea what was going on. Whereas our black audience really connected with it in a way that maybe they wouldn't with something like Sleeping Beauty.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, this is the very significant purpose, isn't it, of what you're doing, changing the stage, literally changing what stories are told. And of course, all of this is also raising the importance of role models, you know, who we see growing up. I know you commented, for example, at the Royal Academy. I think you were in an all-white setting, for example. The importance of role models is part of transformative education, and it's very clear how that can significantly help combat racism. And I'm really interested in how this all feeds into the Ballet Black Junior School, where I think teaching children starts as young as age 3. And I wondered if you'd like to share more about the school and the very specific reason why it's important to start at age 3.
Well, the school came about a year after the company, because it became apparent that, you know, we got to work at both ends, the professional end as well as the church hall end, as I call it, where you get kids at the young age of 3 and all the way up to 18, and you're teaching them ballet. But the difference is, it is an environment where, first of all, they are probably not the only black face in the room, which is certainly true of our school, and that the people in power in the room, the teachers, can be from anywhere. So we have white teachers, black, Asian, mixed race. So we have a really diverse group of teachers. But like the company, there is already no barrier. If your hair is braided, if you want to wear it in an afro, that is all accepted and embraced at the school. Because even today, we still hear stories of schools saying, you've got to cut your braids off, you can't be in the show, you can't do the exam. So none of that exists at our school. Well, the kids are also, you know, it's quite closely connected to the company. So they might get to see, you know, Isabella Corrissi, one of our lead dancers, come in and teach them, or come and see a show and get to see all the Ballet Black dancers up close. So it's very closely connected. And so those role models are right there. Just, they're not a distant figure. It's not like a fan and Beyonce. It's like where you'll never get to meet her or talk to her. It's something that is within touching distance. You know, they can speak to these dancers. The dancers come in, the dancers do a show with the kids at the end of the year where the kids get to perform on stage with the company dancers. So those very real role models are right there and very accessible to our kids. And that, I think, is incredibly important.
Yeah, and it's really interesting. In fact, even when you mentioned Beyoncé, you know, as another role model, because of course currently Beyoncé has topped the US country charts. I think it's the Hot 100 or something like that, because of her country song Texas. And there's alarming backlash. There are, you know, despite topping the charts, there are radio stations that are refusing to play Beyoncé and saying it's not country. We're still surrounded by firsts, and we're still surrounded by barriers, but that the significance of having role models, and that example now with Beyoncé is really important, isn't it? That you can belong. It goes back to what we were talking about earlier, you know, the importance of belonging. You can belong in these spaces.
Yeah. And these people can ban her record and they can say what they want, but she's still number one. So she's fine. And unfortunately, with invented offense and faux outrage and people being anti-woke and, you know, deliberately misunderstanding the meaning of woke, for example, we are always going to have people like that. So we can't attend to them. We can't give them the oxygen that they so desperately want. We just got to get on with it and do what we want. If you want to make a country record, if you want to make a ballet company, you just got to do what you want to do. And if you do it with integrity, it will survive and it will do well, because that's just, you know, the genuine people will find it. You just have to brush up this nonsense, because it's all nonsense. And a lot of it is manufactured and, you know, exaggerated and exacerbated. And I think when you boil it down, there's probably, you know, there's more people pro Beyoncé doing this song than not, because otherwise she wouldn't be topping the charts.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Dolly Parton wouldn't write her a personal message saying, well done, that's amazing, I love your song.
Yeah. And also picking up on integrity. I mean, integrity comes with courage, making the right choices and doing the right thing. It's by no means easy. I mean, you have this fabulous wealth of success, but it's by no means an easy story. You have had to be courageous and draw on your own personal resilience. And actually, going back to your investment in the Ballet Black Junior School and the importance, you know, of reaching children as young as age three, that ties in again with the impact of that tragic death or murder of George Floyd, because I understand that's when you suddenly had all of these institutions or organizations coming after you for consultancy or advice on diversity. And wasn't the point that you were making, or that you needed to make, is you've already lost because it's too late, because it's not an add-on. You know, you're reaching children as young as three. It's too late if they're 13, for example.
Well, I think with classical ballet, and of course there are always exceptions. So those people that jump up and down and say so-and-so started at 13, at 16, of course there's always going to be a few exceptions. But generally, if you want to train a child to be a great ballet dancer, or at least have a chance at being a great ballet dancer, you've got to start young, because you've got to train your entire body to rotate outwards. Your legs have to rotate out. You have to be flexible. You have to be strong. You have to be lean enough that you can be lifted, but not, you know, you still got to be strong and healthy. So there's a balance there. And that takes a really long time to learn and to train. So the younger you can start, the better. And what I found during the 2020 Black Lives Matter moment, because it's ongoing, it didn't just start then and it hasn't stopped, is that a lot of organizations said, we're adding this thing on for teens, we're doing this for teens. And that's great for anyone that wants to have a go at dance. If you are truly saying, we are now going to commit to helping diversify ballet, as in at the church hall level and at professional level, then realistically, you've got to get in there earlier. I think it's three, other people might think it's eight, but I think you've got to get in as young as you can to give kids a chance. Because also, we're not only trying to create more diverse kids going into vocational school, but we're also competing against a lot of other hobbies and activities that kids have available to them today, which didn't really exist when I was a kid growing up. You picked your one thing and you just did it. So, you know, to stay competitive, to keep British ballet alive, we need to be realistic. There's no point coming along when girls are 14 to 16 and saying, now we're going to show you how to do ballet. Boys too, but I'm talking about girls specifically because of point work and how much training that takes. So, you know, if you're saying we're creating some workshops for teenagers and upwards because we just want everyone to know they can get involved and have fun, that's great. If you're saying, I truly want to be part of diversifying the future of dance, whether it's ballet or modern dance or musical theater, then you got to go earlier. And that's just, for me, the only way to do it.
Yeah. And would you say this is reflected in some way in your initiatives with Ballet Black on Film? So it would be good to let the listeners know about the Ballet Black on Film platform, what they can access and see, because I saw that that also includes on-demand ballet classes, which is really significant. Not everybody can afford ballet. Not everybody has a local ballet class. So I think that is probably very supportive of your investment in education, but also how you're widening access to ballet through film. It seems very significant, including the launch of your mobile screening initiative. So I wondered if you'd like to share that and alert listeners to how else they can access Ballet Black.
Well, another thing that came out of the pandemic was having to figure out how could we still create and perform ballet when we're not allowed in a theatre and we're not allowed to sit together. So we started by making a short film called Like Water, which we did on the beach. And the remit for the choreographer, Matutu Zaley, the dancer from South Africa that I mentioned earlier, was that no one could touch each other. And they had to be spaced out. And I can't remember what the rules were back then, but there was, I don't know if you had to be 6 feet apart from people. So he said, okay, I want to make something. I want to try and make this work and I'll rise to this challenge. And we went down to a beach in, I think it was in Worthing. I can't remember now. My memory is terrible since the pandemic. And we filmed this outside on the beach. So we were in the open air. Nobody touched it. There was no partnering. Nobody lifted anyone or touched anyone. And we created our first film, just 10 minutes long, but really a really powerful short film. And then we had something to offer our audience while we couldn't be in a theater. And so from there, we started to make more film, and we had been offering a class via Instagram Live every Sunday. We said, come and join this class with us. It's free. You just have to follow along. If you've got internet connection, just watch our teacher. And that was quite popular. So we decided we'll record some classes. And so they're on our website, and there's a beginner, intermediate and advanced level at the moment. So you can go on. So if you've got no money, that's fine. All you need to do is be able to have a phone or a laptop. And you can watch this class. You could do it at home in your kitchen. You don't need to have ballet clothes. You don't need to have any knowledge of ballet. Just have a go. No one's watching you because you're in your own home. And so that has proven to be really popular. And that's part of our BB on Film section of our website. And anyone can go on there. There are some free things like the classes, and some of our films are free. And we also created a pay-per-view platform. So there are other things that obviously cost us money. So we ask for a very small contribution towards being able to watch those. So in that way, through this, we were able to reach people across the world, not just people that were coming to the theatres that we were performing at. And so that gave us a bigger reach and enabled us to say to people really far away, here's what is possible. You know, if you believe it and you try and you've got, you know, the talent to be a ballet dancer, if you don't, you could still enjoy it in a different way as an audience member or as someone that takes classes. So there are loads of different ways to get involved in ballet.
Yeah, the art of what is possible. The platform is absolutely inspirational. I'll make sure the links are all signposted on your episode page. What's really intriguing me now is, of course, you have achieved an MBE, the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire. And of course, it's an interesting combination, isn't it? Because it's a huge status that may have brought positive change. You were saying your dad's from Trinidad, and we were mentioning Windrush earlier. I don't know if your family's directly affected by what's currently a scandal in terms of how people have been illegally and wrongfully deported. How do they go together for you?
Well, this is, so I got mine in 2013, I want to say.
Yeah.
Am I right? Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. And so this was pre-Windrush, pre-hostile environment, or at least public knowledge of it. And pre the kind of government behavior that we are experiencing today.
Yeah, the current campaign does clearly refer to this as the Home Office scandal.
Yes.
Which it is. The yes. Justice for Windrush campaign, which yeah. people can find online, it is undeniably a Home Office scandal. It should not be referred to as the Windrush scandal. Windrush refers to people yes. that were invited to their, quote, mother country. So I think we may as well be crystal clear about what the dynamic is here. Hmm.
So that's today's dynamic. And that is not how the world felt in 2013. And at the time, I really believed that the more of us that have these accolades, the more change would come about. And I spoke to friends and colleagues that had them before me and had, you know, much higher level ones. And that was how they felt. And so at the time, you know, it felt like a real recognition of Ballet Black to that date, 2001 to that moment. And it was before we had regular funding. And, you know, every day of Ballet Black was a real struggle. So to have been acknowledged by whomever, I don't know who put my name forward for it, certainly not Ballet Black's Ballet Black team at that time was me and my dancers, and there's no way they would have even thought of doing something like that. So it was a really positive moment in the history of Ballet Black. I wouldn't say it changed. You know, what didn't happen, which I think some people might assume, is we didn't suddenly have money pouring in and offers and come and perform here, come and perform there. What we had was a lot of really goodwill from the dance community saying, well done, that's great recognition of your achievements. So that, although it's very nice, it is not the key to unlocking every single thing you think you want or need when you're running a ballet company.
Yeah, yeah. But it is, again, about having the right to be in that space, isn't it?
Also, you know, what I've noticed recently, what I've thought about more and more as I see my friends and colleagues get these awards, is that nobody ever asks Caucasian people if, you know, they've thought about whether they should accept or not. And it's also like when we're asked, how are you tackling racism? We didn't invent racism. We don't perpetuate racism. We don't enjoy racism. It's not our problem to solve. So I think it transfers through to a lot of things. So I felt in recent times, a lot of people ask me, how can you have that? How can you have that next to your name? And it's not what's being asked of other people of the same level who are white. And I wonder why? Why do all of us have to justify these things when, you know, Caucasian people can see the Windrush or Home Office scandal happening and unfolding? They could equally say, no thanks. So I think it's interesting that it feels like another burden on people of the global majority to have to answer those questions, because it always seems to come in a negative way when people are being questioned about it. But I think the perception is that you've got this key to a secret society, and well, I didn't get a key, let's put it that way. So if there is a secret society, when you got one of these awards. I haven't been inducted into it. So it, at the time, it was a really great moment, because it was at a real point where I was thinking, I can't keep doing this, because I just, it's just a completely thankless, it was such a slog. It was such a slog to have no regular money and people saying there's no need for it. Oh, there's no racism in ballet. What are you talking about? You're making up problems where they don't exist. And that was a sort of a daily grind, was to try and maintain this thing, because I knew what we were doing was good. The dancers were fabulous. The work we were creating was great. The kids loved their classes. The people were happy in the environment. But at that point, it was still only very much myself, by, you know, on me on my own and the dancers. And it was a real point where I was thinking, I don't know how much more I can do to, as one person, to keep it going. So the MBE coming through was like, wow, my God, somebody thinks what I'm doing is good. Maybe someone else is seeing what I'm doing and what we are doing as a group. And it really helped keep me going in a time where I thought, I'm not sure if I can maintain this anymore.
Yeah, being a pioneer, as you say, does come with huge burdens and frustrations. The world of discrimination, all forms of discrimination, including racism, is the space we can all belong to. Everybody can reject discrimination and racism. It seems I should leap to my last question because of time, and I know you have rehearsals to get to, but actually you were just saying about, you know, that struggle to keep going. And the arts have a powerful relationship in terms of people's well-being, for example, or even just the commitment to the role the arts can play in social justice. How do you respond to the question, Casa? Can art save us?
I think that art saves and sustains us every day, and we don't always even notice it. Because during that pandemic, when we were all sitting at home watching telly, we were watching professional writers work, professional actors, makeup artists, costume designers, set designers, composers. That's all art. Your favorite comic book, your favorite ballet, your favorite style of dance. It is all art, and it all comes from artists, and it's everywhere. It's in the music we listen to. It's in the clothes we wear. It's in the wallpaper we choose. Art is part of the fabric of life. It's not just a trip to the theater at Christmas that might feel like your artistic day out. Everything we're doing, from the makeup colors you wear to the, how you style your hair, all comes from art. And I think it saves us every day, and it sustains us throughout life.
Beautifully said. I obviously must thank you for your time today. I'm very conscious you need to literally run off to your rehearsals, I will make sure everything is signposted on your episode page, including your current shows, tour dates. I'm sorry we haven't had time to go into that, but I'll make sure it's all signposted.
Thank you.
And I want to say not just thank you for your time today, but for the hugely significant contribution you've made to this country, the positive change that you have single-handedly, and then with your team and growing ballet company, the significant change you've made for the better in Britain in terms of diversity and encouraging diverse audiences and more people to take part in ballet. Thank you so much, Casa, for your time today.
Thank you very much for having me.